Peace, party people. Welcome back to Where My Killer Tape At. This is episode 117. I bring the brother from the same mother, DJ Distolo, so we could do a nice review, filled with spoilers, by the way, of Judas and the Black Messiah. Word. Check it out. Killer Tape At, B. Peace, party people. Welcome back to Where My Killer Tape At. I bring back an old guest, DJ Distolo. What's up, Distolo?
Yo, peace. I'm a young guest, but I'm like we say in the radio world, first time, long time, right? Or not actually, it's long time now.
True indeed. And you are the first guest of 2021, just FYI.
It's an honor.
No doubt. No, thank you, man. So the reason why I haven't come out with a podcast for a while is because I had a long list of them, but they were kind of like doom and gloom, and I didn't want to do that. So I'm trying to do some more upbeat podcast episodes. So a lot of people have been asking me to do a review of Judas and the Black Messiah, and I wanted to bring someone whose critiques I trusted and also who's familiar with the Black Panther Party for self-defense and who's read several of the material. But also, you know, like, again, you watch a lot of movies. So I wanted to bring DJ Distolo, my brother from the same mother. A lot of people always ask him, yeah, that's my physical. So you know how we do here when we do our movie reviews. We talk about the good, the bad, and then the ugly. We're definitely going to ask first, Distolo, how did you feel about the movie overall?
Overall, it was a great movie. I mean, it was entertaining. I guess it covered subject matter. I think that people sometimes feel like because it's based on a true story that it's a biopic, but we need to take that away from the overall. But in terms of quality, direction, acting, I think they knocked out the park. I think we can say it's a classic. I know people are gonna don't like that, throw that word around, or they throw it around too much. But yeah, they knocked out the park, I say. So,
you know, I'm gonna be honest with you. I came into this movie with bad expectations. Not, you know, I like Daniel Kaluuya. I like homeboy Lakeith Stanfield. I know it was screenwritten by the Lucas brothers. I'm a big fan of the Lucas brothers. But you know, they do comedy. So like I didn't think it was gonna, you know, not hating, but I didn't think it was gonna come off as this dope. So my expectations were low, but it was an amazing movie. I will say it is probably, I know it's early in the year, but this is probably going to be one of the best movies of 2021. It's already winning all these awards. Daniel Kaluuya has to win an Academy Award for this. If he doesn't, I mean, I don't expect the Academy Awards to get it right. So I'm going to go ahead and say he's not going to win it. But if he wins it, I wouldn't be surprised. I think everybody in here does a stellar performance. I'm blown away. He sounds like Fred Hampton Sr. I did learn that Fred Hampton Jr. was a consultant on this show.
Yes. So was Fred Hampton's widow as well. She was a consultant. Yeah.
Deborah Johnson. And I want to say that...
that's her... She actually changed her name. And I don't have it on right now. I don't want to butcher her name or try. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was her old name. She changed her name. Respect. I would pull it up, actually.
True indeed. But I just wanted to say that, like, DJ Distolo said, the movie is written from the perspective of William O'Neill, not for Fred Hampton Sr. Because I hear a lot of complaints saying, "Ooh, I wish it had more Fred Hampton in it." And I'm like, it's not written from his perspective. It's written from William O'Neill's perspective. So that's why you have more of William O'Neill's character in it versus Fred Hampton. I don't understand why people didn't get that. It's called Judas and the Black Messiah. So, and I just want to point out real quick before we jump in that there's very little material written about Fred Hampton Sr. because he was 21 when he was murdered.
Yeah.
He was very young. And he was a Panther for about 18 months, maybe close to 2 years, but he was active in, you know, he was an activist for about a year and some change before he became a Black Panther. So he didn't write anything down because he didn't have, you know, he died before he could do that. He was killed before he could do that. A lot of books mention him. But the thing is, a lot of the people that wrote about the Black Panther Party were usually from California. So they had very little interactions with Fred Hampton Sr. So just wanted to point that out. There is a book about the assassination, but it focuses more on the assassination and the life of, because once again, he was only 21. So there's not a lot written about him. He didn't write a lot of stuff. He didn't write anything about himself. We just have a few video clips. And that's not saying that his contribution wasn't major. It was tremendous, but that's why I can see why they wrote it from William O'Neill's perspective.
I mean, that's a good point. I didn't think about it in that term. I think more like my opinion is that they wrote it from O'Neill's perspective because, like you said, he lived longer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's easier to, you know, like I said, there isn't much on Fred Hampton, obviously, because of the time and because of his short life. So I guess they have eyewitness accounts like from his family, which is great. They consulted his family, which is something we'll talk about. But yeah, I mean, O'Neill lived longer. So there's more, I guess, information, and there's obviously more written information about O'Neill due to the Freedom of Information Act. Like, yes. I guess now at this point, you can probably pull all his files. So that would also help in terms of building a storyline.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to go ahead and jump into and here's another question that I have, and I think we'll address it later on, just in the back of your mind. A lot of us saw it on, you know, in our living rooms because of HBO Max. Would it have been received different if it was in a theater? So we're going to get into that later on. But first, the good. What was the good parts of the movies that you saw?
I mean, where do we start?
You could hit one, then I hit one, and then you hit one, and then I hit one.
I think, Daniel did a great, a great job. Like you said, doing the accent or his voice. I'm not going to say his accent per se, but like the way he spoke. And I think Daniel's a kind of slim dude, so he kind of like put on the weight. Like he has like the character and the physical build. He kind of like really did the work and knocked it out. So I think, you know, the casting was excellent. William O'Neill, I saw the video of him, you know, when he was on the interview or whatever. And actually, Lakeith kind of looks like him, like the way they made him look, like he kind of, because I didn't think about O'Neill, like you don't really, you kind of have a certain feeling about him, so you're very biased about him, so you don't care. You don't care if they knocked him out or not. You know what I'm saying? You don't really care if they. And Stansfield has a kind of typecast, and that people have been saying that. So, but he actually, when I saw like the back, you know, they had the video of him being interviewed, mm-hmm. and they showed it like together, and I'm like, wow, he actually looks like him. So the casting was great, and his widow, whose name is Akua and Jerry, they casted her well. Like, I mean, the casting was excellent. Like, the acting was excellent. So I think that's kind of where I'll start with the good.
And just FYI, for those that are wondering, the sequel to the wonderful documentary I talked about in my previous podcast, Eyes on the Prize, William O'Neill is in that. They have that interview. Like, they have that long interview with him in it, in Eyes of the Prize, the sequel to that. So if you want to get that, and I agree with you on the Keith Stanfield, like, they really picked the casting. Just, it makes a big difference. And I know Daniel Kaluuya has been getting a lot of flack for portraying, you know, African-American characters. And he's been gracefully challenging that. But then again, he just really knocks it out the park with his performance. But one of the good that I took from this is that a lot of times when they portray like the police, they'll always have like caricatures of the police. So they'll have like a racist cop, but then they'll have like the quote-unquote good cop.
Yeah, they would have a good conscience, cop. Exactly.
And then, like, he's kind of, like, grappling. Whether should I help you? Oh, my God. This is against, you know, they didn't do that. Everybody, all the FBI guys were seen as slovenly, sloppy. They were drinking alcohol in the middle of the daytime. You know, Martin Sheen, shout out to Martin Sheen, Daytonian. He plays J. Edgar Hoover. I didn't recognize him at
first. Me neither. He looked old, man.
I was like, they made him look like J. Edgar Hoover. Like, they really was like, they made him look evil. And I thought that was really dope how they portrayed the FBI, which they were. They are. They were, you know, yeah, like grimy. they were they were all grimy. They still do that to this day where they set people up, you know, and they hire informants. And, you know, J. Edgar Hoover did say, COINTELPRO said, is to bring down the rise of a black messiah. So it wasn't just, he didn't just survey Martin Luther King. He also surveyed the Black Panther Party, and he was instrumental in eradicating the Black Panther Party. So they never had, they never did the, oh, we have, this is a couple of bad apples. And, you know, there's some good ones. And I think that I really appreciated that, because a lot of times, I know Hollywood is really good at saying, oh, all the white people have to be redeemable, and they just have a couple of bad ones. And I'm like, I like that they really showed that. I really appreciated that. They showed the formidable, you know, enemy of the FBI that the Black Panther Party had to face.
You're right. And I think that's a good point. Like, I mean, that's, I didn't really get into that one. But, you know, like, the, especially the FBI. So if you study the Black Panther Party and how they were infiltrated, it was one through informants. But like I said, yeah, they always had to pick somebody that's vulnerable, that's having some kind of issue. And then the another way they did it, which they did to Fred Hampton, is they'll run into the system. They'll litigate you. They'll make you go to jail. They'll make you fight, fight in court until you can't no more, until you deplete your funds. So they covered those aspects, even though albeit briefly, but they did cover them, which is good. And you said they didn't really have this good cop or somebody always trying to, you know, save the day. So it's, that's a good point.
And no, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because COINTELPRO was very specific in how they, and they hit those points throughout the movie. You'll see J. Edgar Hoover say, well, you know, let's do this to them, right? Let's put the pressure on them to deplete their funds. And then, oh, okay, now we're going to put informants in. Now we're going to send, you know, we're going to send dissension amongst them, because a lot of times the FBI, what they would do was they would write a letter to, you know, Huey Newton. They say, Huey Newton, you know, so-and-so from this chapter said they didn't like you.
Yeah, they did,
you
know, they did it to the gang. Remember, they did it to the
it was a fictional. Well, they did it to the Gangster Disciples. I think that was the Gangster Disciples.
Yeah,
it was to the GDs, where it was like saying, hey, you know, no, it wasn't.
It was a fly. It was the green. Is it the green hats or something?
Yeah, they it was a different gang.
Yeah,
but they actually did that. They actually
they would make flyers and stuff. Yeah,
yeah, and they would, letters. But they would also write letters, and they would also write letters to different prominent leaders saying, "Well, so and so said this and that about you," you know. And then they also brought up George Sands. George Sands was another informant.
Oh yeah, from New Haven.
I thought that was really dope. Yeah, I thought that was I thought that was that one R&B singer. What is his name? Chris. I thought it was him, but it was that dude, because I've seen him before. Terry L. Hill, he played George Sands. He was another informant that actually killed someone. And then, because back then what the Black Panther Party used to do was, in their newspaper, if you was an informant, they would call you out.
You, yeah.
Yeah, they would say, hey, this person is an informant. Or they would say, you know, Dan Trezomi is no longer a member of the Black Panther Party because he stole funds. And they would give you a warning, because a lot of people used to come in their name. And he took advantage of that. You know, so they bought him up, George Sams, which to show once again the deviousness, the levels of the FBI. So,
exactly.
Anything else that you saw that was good?
Well, I also think how the like you said, they portray the police how they're supposed to be portrayed. And I think they also show the inner workings of the Panthers, that, you know, at the end of the day, the Panthers were human, so they might have had some, you know, family squabbles, or even we're not even talking about the informants, but it's in general, like they had a lot of. There were issues, you know, they had issues because of the FBI, because of the pressure, because of community building alliances and stuff. So those things are normal. Those things, it's not like we out here doing this. Yeah, they are doing it, but there's a lot of obstacles. So I think it was good that they showed that they were human, that they were people, you know, and they also, it's all about love, not necessarily self-defense and shooting cops, which, I mean, whatever, it was self-defense when they shot at the cops, but they showed the humanity of the Black Panthers. Like I said, this is not a, it's not a documentary about the Black Panthers, but I think it's important that they, I mean, it's not a biopic either, so it's important that they portray, you know, what was really happening.
I'm glad you said that. Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because Kathleen Cleaver talks about this a lot. And Kathleen Cleaver was also a member of the Black Panther Party. She was married to Eldridge Cleaver. And she pointed out that the average Black Panther member was like 19 years old.
Wow, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, when they started the Black, they were older. They were like, they're like 23, 24, 25. But the average Black Panther Party member was 19. I mean, Bobby Hutton was 16. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mumia Abu-Jamal was 16 when he joined the Black Panther Party. So, like, he's pretty much, what my point is, these were kids. and they were fighting against the FBI. Like we got to really look at that perspective. These were children. These were babies who were fighting against the FBI. So of course they're gonna have, and I'm not trying to diminish the Black Panther part. I'm just saying, I just want people to just think about this, that a lot of them were young. So of course they had the problems that a lot of young people face, coming of age, you know, learning things that their parents were probably like not didn't approve of. And a lot of the Panthers face that, you know, a lot of their parents are like, well, what are you doing? You know, like you're probably just as bad as maybe a drug dealer, maybe a gangbanger, you know, and that's what they saw it as. And there was a lot of old, you know, their parents were probably like, well, we should be more nonviolent, you know, like Martin Luther King, not hating, but Martin Luther King, we should be going doing that. And we saw a lot of that. We see a lot of how a lot of young people moved away from what their parents may have raised them. So I think that's very important. And also you pointed something else out, is that one of the reasons why I didn't join the new Black Panther Party was because they weren't doing the survival programs that the Black Panther did, such as free breakfast programs, you know, vaccination programs, you know, free medical clinics, you know, helping people buy groceries. You know, I know Young Lords Party in New York, they did stuff against sanitation. They didn't want to pick up trash in the hood. Like just all these things that they were doing because they were actually meeting the needs of the people.
Yeah, and you know, those things are militant. They're not necessarily militant, you know, that you're actually attacking or fighting, but it's actually militant, and these things are helping the community. Those things are militant. Those things that they don't provide us with, you know. So
yeah, those are revolutionary. Yeah, those are radical programs. So, and I'm glad that they showed like everybody else but the Panthers had guns. I thought that was really crucial. I was like, they only had guns at one point, but the rest of the time they were like, oh, we got to raise funds for the free breakfast programs. Oh, let's do political education classes because you got to get political. You got to get educated on what we're talking about. You know, like let's talk about capitalism. Let's talk about socialism. And I was like, they really, because a lot of times when you think of Black Panther, you just think of guns, you know, and black leather. And this movie really, and I really, really appreciated that. I really, really appreciated that.
Definitely.
Anything else you wanted to add on?
I also think what's important, we always point out in movies, I think how they portrayed the women in the Panthers. And of course, during this time and through most movements, there's always sexism and patriarchy, you know, even in the most militant revolutionary movements. So I think they did a great job portraying women. Once again, Ms. Johnson, who was Fred Hampton's girlfriend, widow. You know, I'm bad with names, man.
Dominique Fishback. She is the bomb. Fishback and, did a very dope job. I liked her in Power. I didn't realize how old she was.
Yeah.
But I liked her in Power with Jamie Foxx. She did her thing with Jamie Foxx. If you haven't seen Power, please go see that. Is that was the name of that movie?
I'm not even sure. Like
Netflix?
I know she was.
It's on Netflix. Yeah,
she was in a couple movies. I mean, she doesn't have a big like discography, whatever. But she she did a thing, man. She was good, and her character was written well.
Yeah, written very well. Yep. Now I want to kind of slide into the bad, because Dominique Thorne played a fictional character, Judy Harmon. I felt like she should have gotten more lines. Where, they did put show the women in the party, but they didn't give them lines, you know. Like they would show Bobby Rush, who's still a congressman. He's still a congressman, right?
I think so.
Bobby Rush of Chicago, yeah, they show him, but why did they show other prominent real life women that were in the Black Panther Party? It was enough, but I felt like they should have showed more, and they should have gave Dominique Thorne, who played Judy Harmon, they should have gave her more lines. And they should have gave Dominique Fishback more lines. I kind of felt like, you know, I wasn't happy with that aspect, because the women in the Black Panther Party were very prominent. They had a lot of leadership position. They put in a lot of work. And I wanted to see more of that instead of them just being like secretaries and stuff like that.
True. I mean,
you know, so that was one of the bad. That's one of the bad that I had about the movie that I didn't sit well with me. I don't know if they needed more women in the writer's room. Or, you know, maybe that was left at the cutting room floor. I don't know, but I know that a lot of times, like in that first Panther movie back in 1995, that was directed by Mario Van Peebles, instead of them like showing more women leaders, they just had that one scene where the sisters were like, hey, we're not having it. You know, we in the party too. And they had all the sisters like meet up together, like in Avengers Infinity War.
I was about to say Infinity War.
they raised their black fist up.
That's Hollywood.
And I was like, they just had that one scene.
I'm like, I felt like, yeah.
So, and I was like, man, that part really hurt me. I mean, it didn't take away from the movie, but I was like, that's one something that I had an issue with. I felt like Dominic Thorne should have got more, and Dominic Fishback both should have gotten more lines in it.
I mean, at the same time, I mean, like I said, we know that that Aku and Jerry's was a consultant, so I don't know how much she wanted. You know, like it's very traumatic, so I'm not sure how much they wanted.
That stuff could have been left on the cutting room floor. Like they may have been deleted scenes. They may have been stuff like let's take it out.
Yeah,
like. Maybe they had more. Dominic Thorne had more lines. She's going to be Riri Williams in Marvel, by the way, party people. But maybe they had more lines for her and they cut it out. Who knows? But that's one thing that I had an issue with. Like, you know, because you could be a consultant and you could say, hey, X, Y, Z, and they could just completely ignore you.
Did you know that Rosa Clemente was also involved with the movie? I don't know if you knew that.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she spoke about that. You know, people had critiques of the movie, and then she had to go out and defend the movie because she was involved with it. So, like I said, we can talk about the critiques that people have that don't necessarily take away from the film, unless, you know, that's how you feel about it. But yeah. People have critiques. Maybe we can talk about that in the bad. But
and then we're in the bad now.
Yeah, so I'll talk about it. I guess people wanted more a nuanced take on Fred Hampton's philosophy and his politics. I mean, they brushed on him briefly, but they didn't get into it. No.
Which here's my thing with that. My thing with that is, and I'm not trying to take away nothing from Fred Hampton Sr. I'm not trying to take anything from him. He joined the Black Panther Party for their ideology. So what he was doing was Black Panther ideology. Remember, the Black Panther Party in Oakland and in LA comprised of several former gangbangers. You know what I'm saying? That's the reason why a lot of times members of the Black Panther Party throughout the country have beef with people, because they brought a lot of that stuff, that baggage with them when they became Black Panthers. You know what I'm saying? A lot of people on the street just saw them as another gang, which if you want to see some more information on that, get the DVD of the Mac, where they interview a lot of people that was in the staff of the Mac, and they talked about how there were people that had beef with the Black Panthers, just street beef. It was street beef in Oakland. So it's a real interesting extras that they have there.
Yeah.
But I think that's very crucial to the discussion, because Fred Hampton wasn't doing anything unique. Maybe it had been unique to Chicago, but that's what the Black Panther Party was doing. They was recruiting young people who were former gangbangers. And Huey Newton called them the lumpen proletariat. So if you want to read more about his ideology, just read Revolutionary Suicide by Huey Newton. Just read Seize the Time by Bobby Seale, because that's literally what he was doing. Matter of fact, in the movie, he says we're socialists.
No, I mean, exactly. I think people wanted a more nuanced take. They didn't want to just hear it, you know? Because people, I mean, especially now in this climate, you know, people throw around the word socialist around, and it's like either you hate or you love it. There's no nuanced talk about what people can't even define it. People don't know what it is. Certain things are socialism. They say,
but that goes back to what I said. That goes back to what I said, that you need to study the works of Huey Newton, Bobby Seale. Bumi Abdul-Jamal has a wonderful book on the Black Panther Party. And he actually, in that book, he explains the political evolution of the Black Panther Party, because I'm not going to get too deep into it, but he talks about how originally they were what he called Malcolmists. And he actually quotes Huey Newton saying, you know, we're Malcolmists, and then how they evolved into socialism. So I always tell people, like, you just got to read this stuff. And that's what Fred Hampton was reading. You know, that's what they were all reading, the same books. They were reading Mao. They were reading, you know, Marxism. They were reading all that stuff. They were reading Antoine Gramsci.
I mean, they bigged up like a lot of
French Fanon.
They bigged up like Mao and even Che Guevara. I think if they were name checking them. But like I said, people wanted, I guess, more concrete, you know. Yeah. Information, but it's a movie. It's not a documentary. Yeah. It's not a book.
We want freedom. We want freedom of life in the Black Panther Party by Mubi Abdul-Jamal. I cannot recommend that book enough, because he gets into how he got in and then what he learned and all of that stuff, and where Huey was coming from when he talked about socialism. And I think, again, those things are important, And you're right. There is, in this climate, there's this thing where you either love socialism or you hate it, but you don't even know what it is. Anything else that you saw that was bad?
See, I'm trying to think because, yeah, I think we've
got... I know. I'm going to say this was the tough one. Usually I can pick good and bad and ugly and move along and be like, yo, this is what I think and everything without taking away from the movie.
I think the one thing which is kind of like a recurring theme in Hollywood is people are upset when a British actor, I think you spoke about it earlier, a British mm-hmm. actor taking place of American actors portraying African-American characters. So, I mean, whether we say it's bad or not, I like the work he did. I was impressed. And if you see him, he's done a lot of press for the movie, obviously. He's been doing a lot of promotion.
Yeah, he does a lot.
And he speaks about it. Like, he consulted with the family. He spoke to the family, and they were like, they gave him his blessing. And, you know, he was serious about it, and he did his work. So I don't have a problem with it, but certain people do, you know.
So, I think it's messed up that a lot of times we tend to blame victims of racial discrimination versus the actual system.
Yeah.
And I think this is the same thing here. Instead of blaming Daniel Kaluuya, we should blame the British
cinematic industry, I guess.
Yeah, the cinematic industry, because they're so racist that black people from the UK have to go to other markets to just work. You know what I mean? And I know, and it's funny because a lot of times if you go to the UK and you go to the theater, it's chock full of black people that can act their ass off, you know, or people of African descent or Caribbean descent, however you want to dice it. And they can act their ass off, but they're kind of, it's like a ceiling. They can't go but so far because of their film industry. So they come here. My
question for you.
For years, they've had African Americans playing African all the time.
Mandela, you know what I'm saying?
So it's like,
My question for you is, does Hollywood feel like British actors are more polished or more quote-unquote professional than African American actors? Well, I mean, black British. Is there like this stereotype or a bias where they feel like?
I don't think there is. And then again, I'm not in Hollywood, but I know that there are black actors that I enjoy who they get work. They may not get put into blockbuster movies, but they get work. Lakeith Stanfield stay working. You know what I mean? Denzel stay working. Courtney P. Vance stay working. Like. All the black actors that I enjoy, they stay. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I was laughing at Denzel because, you know, like we made comparisons to like Malcolm X and Fred Hampton in terms of like the movies and the actors and But yeah, you know, I mean, you're right. I mean, I'm not saying but I'm saying lately, you know, it's been a lot of, you know, for newer guys that are breaking to the scene, it seems to be more British. Like Daniel's been getting a lot of work, you know, considering we 3 years ago we didn't know who he was. You know what I'm saying? So,
but he's been getting work from black directors and black screenwriters.
True that, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I think again, from the I love Daniel Kaluuya. I love him. But there are other black actors that I like more, and I see them in a lot of stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like I see them in mad stuff. So when I hear that, I'm like, what are y'all watching? Because the people that I like, whether they black, Asian, or whatever.
Yeah.
They're getting work, you know.
But
I mean?
Then are like, they? I'm sorry to keep hitting you with these questions, but are they recycling the same guys? Like, are they gonna get a Denzel?
I will say this:
Keith and then Angela Bassett always plays all the female roles, you know. So
I will say this: Hollywood has this thing where Hollywood has this thing where they only got to be one black dude and one black woman who's gonna be in all the movies.
Yeah, I mean
they will do that. Yeah, they do that. I will admit to
that. But you're right. That's a symptom of Hollywood, not of.
That's a symptom of Hollywood, not. Yeah, you know, and we always blame people like, you know, we'll blame Daniel Kaluuya, we'll blame all of them. And I'm like, you know, we'll blame Tyler Perry, but I'm like, Tyler Perry's not the problem. It's Hollywood that's the problem. Tyler Perry's just doing what he could do.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And he's putting people on. So like that, you know, at one time it was just Spike Lee, you know what I mean? And he kind of used the same people. He uses his friends, right? But we got to blame the system versus blaming Daniel Kaluuya is a victim in this. I know we're looking at it like, man, he's making mad money. Yeah. He's getting mad awards, but he had to leave where he was from to get work. You know what I mean? If he can get work where he was from, we probably never would have heard of him before.
Exactly. What I'm saying. Like that's the thing with the British actors. So, but then we don't even know they're British until we hear them speak in an interview, which is funny.
But then at the same time, there are white British actors that get work and nobody complains about them. Like my man that plays Spider-Man, he's British. You know what I'm saying? He's Australian, I think. I could be wrong, but you know, all the people that we like, they Australian or that's like British the, or whatever, whatever.
The Wire you is know? Like,
Oh my, The Wire is the worst because it's all supposed to be for Baltimore. Yeah, it's
like Stringer Bell and then my man McNulty was McNulty's
cop.
Like,
yeah, the cop. He's Australian, I think.
No, I think he's British.
You think he's British?
Yeah, but okay. It's funny because there was an episode where he had the fake Scottish accent. So he's like a British actor.
British,
playing a Baltimore street cop, imitating a Scottish accent, which is hilarious. But yeah, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent.
No, you're right. I remember, and here's another thing we don't nobody talks about. When they're doing a movie or a series about Rome or Greece, all of them are British actors.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's what happens. Like,
you know what I'm saying? And it's just like, I know there's this thing about, well, they speak a particular English, but we never talk about it on that side. We never, and I know maybe I'm splitting hairs or whatever, but I'm like, you know, you don't hear Tom Cruise saying, yo, why are all these British actors coming through? You know what I mean?
Like, so, true that.
So, yeah. So what was another bad thing you saw from the movie that you, or you have a criticism that you want to address?
No, I think that's the one. I mean, that wasn't a criticism of mine. I think that was a criticism that people were throwing around about the British actors occupying space for African American actors. No, I can't think. I'm trying to think offhand. I don't.
Yeah, because there was a lot of critiques that I didn't agree with. And like, other than the women part, I didn't have any other bad, you know, things that should have been done differently. I think the pacing of the movie was great. It was the timing was just right, because a lot of times they'll make these movies extra long.
You're right. Yeah.
You know,
it wasn't too long.
They didn't do that. They didn't get too much into like Lakeith Stanfield as William O'Neill. He was very straightforward. It wasn't like, oh, where's my moral compass? And, you know, he was very, you know, but if you look at his interviews, he was very clear about what he was doing. And mind you, after the murder of Fred Hampton Sr., he was involved in other murders and other.
Yeah, they say how much he won. Like, he made X amount of money between here and there. And
yeah,
I mean, it's at the same. Yeah, I think that, you know, they nailed him as well. Like, he was, yeah, he had issues and there was some desperation about him that you might be like, damn, that's kind of sad. And I don't know if you saw it for him, but it's really sad. And it's kind of like you said, that the FBI has a, you know, they have a history of they'll find the perfect victim and to lay it on. So it's like, you kind of don't have a choice. You're stuck between a rock and a hard place. So, you know, not to give him a free pass or anything, but they do that. They'll find, they know who to find. They're not going to turn somebody. They're not going to turn Fred Hampton, obviously. So they'll find somebody who know they can turn, who's vulnerable, and they'll run with it. You know what I'm saying? And they'll make him seem like it's on you. You know what I'm saying? So it's, I think the perspective of his, you know, I think they nailed it. Like, you know, you don't feel sorry for him. You kind of like, this dude, he's, I mean, it's a sad character. He's a really sad character.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're like, well, you know, he made the decision, you know. And he was like, at one point, he was like, I'm done. I did what you want. And they were like, no, you didn't. You still got to do five years or whatever. So, but.
Well, actually what happened was he didn't say he was done. What he said was he wasn't going to poison Fred Hampton.
I remember, but it was like, okay, you got him.
He said, I'll do something else. Yeah. I'll do something else, but I'm not going to do that.
No, but when he was in jail, wasn't he like, he's in jail now. What do you want from me? You know, like, he's already in jail now. And they were like, no, we want to continue on. Then they were like, you still have 5 years to do.
Okay.
Remember, because they were like, you got the charge for the weapon charge, but now you got a charge for impersonating an officer. And then they kind of like say, you have to do this as well. And then.
So you're right. My bad. Because I remember him saying there was a point where he was like, well, I'll do something else, but I'm not going to do that.
Ugly for me? Little Rel. I was like, I'm like, come on, man. I guess he's playing the black FBI agent. But it was like, I don't know if Little Rel, like, I guess if he was there for comic relief. I don't know. When I saw his name, I was like, what is he playing? You know, like you said, when you saw the directors were like, they write comedy. So you're like, why would they do this movie? And I'm like, why is Little Rel in this? And I'm like, they had him in there for that. So that would be the ugly for me.
There's a reason why, because he's a fictional character too.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a reason why they did that. The story goes is they gave the poison directly to William O'Neill. They didn't. There wasn't an intermediary.
Okay.
So what they wanted to show was the scene where he hands them the fake ID.
Yeah, that's,
and that was a writer's decision. Was it a good one? I don't know. I don't know. But I guess they wanted to show like that he had kind of like a conscience and he was having second, because he did say, I don't want to poison him, I'll do something else. And then he shows him that fake badge, and it was kind of like to remind him, like, hey, look, you went this far, you're gonna do this. And I think that's what that was for, because that actually never, that scene.
Okay, that happened. Yeah, happened. But I thought he was like a black FBI agent, which I'm like.
So no, they didn't have any black FBI agents back then. They had informants. They had police officers, like local police officers, who were black that helped out the FBI. They might have gone undercover, but the FBI did not have any black people back then.
Okay.
In the FBI, okay. You know what I'm saying? There's actual stories. Carl Kahn's in his book, The Judas Factor, The Plot to Assassinate Malcolm X. There's actually stories of white men in blackface trying to infiltrate Nation of Islam.
That's funny. Yeah, that's hilarious. Nuts. I mean, it's not funny, but that's crazy.
That's how racist they were. They were like, well, we can't trust black people, but we are going to paint ourselves black and try to infiltrate that. There's stories of that, which I think is mind-blowing.
J. Edgar Hoover had an archetype, which is kind of general white supremacy archetype, white male, you know what I'm saying? So a white male like certain, well, I want to say Ivy League, but it's like a white male from a certain kind of school. Like he had his archetype for agents. Yep. So obviously he wasn't going to deviate from that.
He was very clear.
Yeah, but I didn't see the point of having Little Rel in it. Like,
no, I mean, again, it's one of those things. I talk to the kids about this all the time, how like, because they read manga and we'll watch the anime and they'll be like, why do they do that? It's not even in the book. And I said, well, it's usually writers take certain liberties to keep the pacing of the story and kind of like remind the audience, like, hey, boom. And I mean, some of them are bad decisions and some of them are, they kind of make sense. And this one, I will say it kind of makes sense. And I didn't even think about that because the Lucas brothers, they write comedy.
Yeah.
So, they must have threw that in there.
I thought they had somebody serious though. You know? I mean, even they picked that scene, they could have picked somebody. When I saw his name, I was like, "What is Lil Rel doing in this?" I was like, "Maybe he got a breakthrough role, like you know."
Because when I saw the name, I was like, "What are they going to put?" I thought they was going to make him like a Panther, and then he just popped up as a pimp, and I was just like, "Oh snap!" So like, I was like, "Wow, that's crazy." So he did his thing in there. Anything else you want to talk about? Any of the critiques or anything? Or
I guess we can talk about. I mean, legacy is kind of a big word throughout there, but I guess what this will do in terms of moving forward, like making movies about, and like I said, Fred Hampton is a very, I don't mean to say touchy, but like Hollywood would never do a story about Fred Hampton. Like that's why it would be Judas and the Black Messiah. It wouldn't be the Black Messiah, you know? So I think moving forward, it's like to see like when Hollywood takes a shot at these kind of movies and we see what we get. Like we can talk about Malcolm X and I guess Fred Hampton, and we'll see what happens. Well, you know, Spike Lee obviously is always going to be a black director or a black writer.
But you know, I wouldn't compare the two, not because I'm not trying to like compare them like all this.
No, they're 30 years apart too. So that's, I mean,
you can't take it out of context, right? You know, Malcolm X was filmed at a different time and climate in our country. Didn't have the internet. I can go on and on about the differences in the budgeting and.
Before it comes out.
So, you know, Malcolm X could have probably been done today with no haps. You know what I'm saying? Whereas back then it was just, Spike Lee faced so many problems. And yes, Denzel got snubbed. He didn't even get another thing.
And people probably gonna kill me for this, but I'm like, I like Denzel, but I think he did a great job. But there's a little bit of Denzel in that. I'm just like, I think the speeches and stuff are excellent. Like he nails the speeches and the mannerism, the tone. But like in between, like it's to me, it reeks of Denzel. You know what I'm saying? But people come in for that, and I'm like, because people.
And that's not a bad.
Oh no, that's not. I mean, he put a stamp on it. But like you know, when the what was the movie? The Regina King movie.
It's kind of like that Mandela movie with Idris.
Oh, yeah. I didn't see that, but
that's Idris. Yeah, he did a dope job, but I was like, that's Idris. Yeah. Like. That scene right there is Idris. That's Idris Elba. That's Idris. So I think everybody kind of puts their stamp on whoever they play.
But at the same time, because I'm saying once somebody puts a stamp on it and then like it negates anybody else after, that's not fair. Like you talk about the movie, the Regina King movie, whatever you feel about the guy who played Malcolm X. But it's like people are going to always compare it to Malcolm X, to Denzel. And I'm like, that's not fair. Like, we have to hold it up for what it is, you know?
I agree. And that's going back to what I said earlier with the context
of
that, you know, like you got to look at the context of it. And Hollywood was really on that only one black actor bullshit.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like,
exactly.
Yeah, back then. So like, but yeah, I just, because it's because of the context. I wouldn't, because they were filmed in the same year or a couple of years apart. True. Then I'd be like, oh, definitely let's compare. But it's just the context of it is different. You know, I think Spike Lee would have gotten away with doing a Malcolm X movie faster and better now than he did back then. So, but at the same time,
it's like we have to wait this long to get these kind of movies too, which really points to how terrible Hollywood is. Like, we don't get these.
And that's probably the ugly that we should focus on. Like, you know, this movie could have been done before. And we could have had several different actors and actresses play, several different screenwriters write it, but Hollywood was just not trying to hear it. I definitely agree with that sentiment. Like, you know, and I'm glad, because to be quite honest, you know, I'm such a big admirer and researcher of the Black Panther Party that I never imagined it could have been done. You know what I'm saying? Like, it may have been done on an independent level and put on YouTube, you know what I'm saying? But not given this kind of fanfare, HBO Max, and, you know, kind of piggybacking what I wanted to talk about earlier about, you know, it would have been a different response. I think it would have been a much bigger response if it was in the theater, if, you know, outside of the pandemic. You know, if we didn't have the pandemic, it probably would have been like,
true.
You know, we would have had, just like Black Panther, we would have had people, oh, you know, my sorority is going to take a whole bunch of people out. You know, my school is going to take X amount. I'm going to do a school trip on this, and we're going to have, you know, papers done on it, and we're going to do curriculum around the Black Panther Party. And I think that would have been a bigger effect, you know, if it was released. It was released in the theater.
But yeah, I mean, nobody, a few theaters, New York, we're not going to theaters. We didn't even open up yet. But yeah. I think that's another good point. I think that the streaming revolution, I hate to use that word, I think that's also forced a lot of these movie makers. So like before, the only competition you had was a silver screen, but now you have Netflix has their own production company. And you have Amazon. So they're going to take chances and they're going to invest in people. They know that people are going to watch it. So they know that people are going to watch it. Yeah. So, and then, you know, so I think that kind of helps where, you know, people are going to get more chances. It's going to be more content that's going to be put out. There's more stuff to be seen. So I think that's helpful. Like I said, Spike Lee, he didn't have that. He had one juggernaut to deal with, which was Hollywood.
Exactly.
And he had to budget it and do his own thing. So I think the fact that there's different avenues now, like you can go to Amazon, Hulu, Netflix, you know, or the traditional routes, I think. And then the movie, you know, Hollywood has to, because they have to compete against these other people. So I think that's, I guess, form some level of competition. I don't know. You know.
No, I think that's, again, going back into the context, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a different market, different competition. You are. They're right. There's more opportunities. Yeah. You know, Ryan Coogler just signed a deal with Disney Plus. It's just, you know, right? Regina King got a deal. Is it with Netflix?
No, she's Amazon.
You know, with Amazon.
What is it? One night, deal, is like, it? A Night in Miami? Like, what's her name?
She's doing a
bunch of stuff. What was the one that I was just talking about? Malcolm X.
Yeah, One Night in Miami. Yeah, yes. One Night in Miami. You know, what's her name has a deal with Netflix?
Shonda Rhimes.
She did Scandal. Yeah, Shonda Rhimes. Like everybody's, you know, has more opportunities. There's more people of color in writing rooms. You know, and it's like there's a lot more opportunities again because there's competition with the streaming services. There's a lot more money to throw around. You know, with technology, it's easier to get stuff done. And it's a different ball game now. And I think there's a demand for it. I think there's like with all these really wonderfully edited and researched documentaries that are out there. There's that desire. There's that, you know, there's a consumer base that I hate to talk about in capitalist terms, but there's a consumer base that wants this kind of movies, right? There's enough room for any kind of genre that's out there. You know, I guess the documentary stuff, puts that thermometer out there. Do you want this kind of content? And I think that helps drive that content to see movies such as Judas and the Black.
And I mean, a lot of people don't want to watch documentaries. Some people don't want to sit through 3-4 hour documentary. So like it's cool. Yeah. I mean, like I said, we obviously the disclaimer that don't get your information from a movie. It's even if it's,
exactly.
if it's based, especially if it's based on a true story. Most movies are or whatever that are say that. So I mean, it's important that you don't get your information. That should be a gateway to you getting a book or find a documentary. Like, I mean, for example, look at the Central Park Five. Like, I mean, that was a great series on Netflix, but it was, you know, it was a series. Like, I wouldn't tell people.
It was dramatized. So a lot of those scenes didn't happen at all. You know what I'm saying? So
it was great acting and it was well shot. But I would tell you, if you love that series, go see the, I think it's Ken Burns or Ken Burns' daughter that did the actual documentary. Central Park 5. I would go to see that. And that would give you a story as to mm-hmm. what happened. So, yeah, I mean, those that can be a starting point.
And their story, and the wild part is that their story hasn't actually been told. Like that's the wild part. Like, you know, other people have told their story, but their story has not been told. Like, the five have not released, you know, material, you know, their own documentaries, you know, like, and I tell people that all the time, like, their story hasn't been, everybody else has told their story. You know, with the Black Panther Party, you could read Huey's books. Yes. You could read Bobby Seale's books. You could read Elaine Brown's book. You could read Asada's, but you could read all of that info. You could read all of that stuff, their perspective of what happened. You know what I mean? And then there's documentaries that their children
done. People that were still there.
That were still there.
First-hand accounts. Exactly, Central Park 5, it's just them, you know? Really, because they were locked up, so.
Yeah, so.
I mean, yeah, you're right.
So, and I'm glad you pointed that out. Like, you know, like, yeah, that's, there's other material that you should read. And it's just the beginning. This is just be like a
exactly.
primer.
It's an entry point. And then, to get these names. You know, and then really do it. I mean, like I said, the technology now, you can find all that information online. You don't even have to go to the library. You can pull that up. You can stream the documentary. The documentaries on Fred Hampton, on the Panthers. There's a lot of great documentaries. So I would say, you know, if you want more information, you know, dive deep into this. The documentaries are good, too. I'm not saying people don't want to sit through documentaries, but they're actually very informative. And it's amazing to see some of the footage from back then. So I'd recommend that.
Yes. Just to FYI, ladies and gentlemen, in my previous episode, I do review some documentaries you should check out for Black History Month and some books. And some of them touch on the Black Panther Party. And really, a lot of the stuff I talked about touched around, you know, the Black freedom rights struggles in the 60s and 70s. That's all connected. So definitely, like, and you know, I'm glad that the movie mentioned certain, they show certain people like Kwame Ture, you know, Huey Newton. They didn't mention their names, but they show them. And I thought that was really dope. You know, like there's a movie about Kwame Ture needs to be made. But
I mean, that's a long, because it's, you know, he goes through several periods. So, I mean, that would be.
Yeah, he goes through several periods. That would be interesting. Yeah,
And then, you know, the different manifestations of Kwame Ture or Stokely Carmichael. How he kind of coined the term Black Panther, and then he eventually, you know, like he's different. Black Power. But he was with the Black Panthers down south, right?
Huey absorbed them into the Black Panther Party. But then he left.
Yeah. I'm saying, but there was the Black Panthers. What happened? There was an actual party, and it wasn't in the South. And then Huey and Bobby Seale kind of adapted it from them, and then they made it into the organization that is. Is that correct?
No. He asked them to come in because they were like the military. They were the SNCC.
Okay.
Kwame Ture was at one point the president of SNCC. Then he just became, I hate to use that term, quote unquote militant. You know. He was like one of the more militant voices in the SNCC. He was actually the head of SNCC for about a year. And then he left. Him and H. Rap Brown and them left. And then Huey later on, there was a Black Panther Party in Alabama, but he was not a part of that. Yeah.
But they predate Huey and Bobby Seale, correct?
Yeah. That's they what predate Huey. And then Huey and Bobby Seale later was like, y'all Black Panthers. Cause y'all kind of like our uncles in this whole shit. You know, the Robert Williams was the guy that wrote Negroes with Guns. They attribute him as being like their godfather because he was the one that was like self-defense. He was the one that was actually showing and proving it. So they used to give out copies of Mao and Negroes with Guns, you know? So like that was by Robert K. Williams, who was like he was a president of NAACP chapter in North Carolina. But Kwame Ture was like a militant wing of the SNCC. He later split from them. So him and H. Rap Brown.
He moved to Ghana.
So yep. Anything else you want to add on before we close out? Before you give your social media accounts?
No, I think that's it. I mean, I would say recommend to go see the movie or stream the movie. And like I said, for the most part, you know, take it for what it is. It's about the Black Messiah. I mean, excuse me. It's about the Judas and the Black Messiah. So understand the perspective of William O'Neill. And it's the movie. It's not a documentary. They're going to take some liberties with the movie. So, you know, if that's a starting point for you, then excellent. And then you can move on to, I guess you can probably put in the show notes, you know, some more information if you want to know about Fred Hampton, the Black Panther Party, et cetera, like a starting point, and then where you would actually get this information, as well as books. I'm sorry. Yeah. So.
Definitely. I'm going to put some in the show notes, but of course, Huey Newton's Revolutionary Suicide, Bobby Seale Sees the Time, Elaine Brown's The Taste of Power, Asada Shakur's Asada. I can't believe I forgot his name for the Young Lords Party. He had a We Took the Streets, the story of the Young Lords Party.
Yeah.
Mickey Melendez. Read that. Because they showed Cha-Cha Jimenez in a movie, and he actually was in the Young Lords Party in Chicago.
That's where they originated. And they originally from Chicago.
Yeah, they created Chicago, yep. And then the cast from New York came over there. They met Fred Hampton, the Young Lords Party, and they started the chapter in New York. And then there's a couple of other ones that I just learned about that I haven't read yet about the Young Lords Party. There's actually a graphic novel about the women in the Young Lords Party. I'm going to put that stuff in the show notes. But there is a lot of material. We can go on and on. I will say this, and then I'm going to leave it alone. This is probably one of the most historically accurate movies I've seen in a while. I'm going to say 65% of the information here is accurate, which is very good for a Hollywood movie. It's very, very good. And I'm not saying that they would lie about certain things. Again, I tell my kids all the time, writers have to take certain liberties for pacing, to make things make a little bit more sense. Because there's some things you just can't get into, that it'll take like a whole another tangent. So that's part of the pacing. So they're gonna dramatize events that didn't actually happen. They're gonna throw in words that actually were never said. And that's just, they do that to all kinds of movies. They don't just do it to Black movies. But I'm gonna say this is probably one of the most accurate ones that I've seen. As a historian, there's very few things that I had that I was like, oh, what y'all do that for? So like, but everybody does that. So not saying it's right, not saying it's wrong, but there's reasons why writers do those kind of things. But it's pretty accurate.
No, I mean, I feel you. I think that it's, like, it's a great portrayal. Like I said, it's not going to give you everything that you want, which is what a lot of people have complaints about. But it gives you it's a good movie. It's entertaining. It, you know, gives you a good perspective. And like you said, there's a lot of truths to it that we can appreciate. And like I said, another thing that we didn't talk, I mean, we spoke about it, but they consulted the family. So they got the blessings of the family. A lot of times that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And it ends up the family, the estate, happen. They usually say, we don't support, we don't endorse this movie. It's nonsense. So it's like, it's wrong, you know, when that happens. I mean, we can talk about legality and money and stuff like that, but you know, they were consulted. And I think that's great that, you know, even Daniel spoke to the family. He got the blessing. So, you know, they had people, you know, they had consultants that we can, you know, Rose Clemente, they had consultants that we can,
I didn't know about
her. It's amazing that they had these people on board. Like, these people wouldn't have certain things happen. So we can appreciate that. Of course, there's always going to be criticisms. People are going to say, well, it's Hollywood and we didn't get this, we didn't get that. Like, No Name had a critique. Well, they asked her to be on the soundtrack. I don't know if you heard about this.
I didn't hear. I know she had a lot of critiques about. I know she.
Yeah, they
I know
asked
she
her to be on a soundtrack, and she was like, "I don't want to be on it because I felt like they didn't address the socialist leanings of Fred Hampton." I mean, but it's, like I said, it's not a documentary. It's not a biopic, which is a funny name in itself. But you know, so I appreciate her stance. I you know, I'm cool that she has principles and she decided to do that. And I like her as an artist. I'm gonna buy her album when it comes out. I like her. She's one of my favorite MCs. I respect her stance. Like, some people wouldn't do that. You know what I'm saying? So I think it's whether you agree with it.
I respect where she's at as well. My point was, go on her Instagram. She has like a really long critique of. She has a really good explanation of why she didn't sign up for it and why she didn't approve of the movie. It's a lot. She put a lot of stuff up there. So if you're wondering about where she stands, she's very clear about where she.
And I respect that. She, like I said, she doesn't pull punches. She went after Beyonce and they dragged her. You know, like, she has critiques that are legit. So you can't be like, whether you agree with her or not, you could be like, I appreciate your honesty and your candor and you put it out there. So that's a lot of people can't do that, especially artists. So, you know, but I didn't mean to go off, but.
No, you're fine. This is the reason why it's a podcast.
I think that's the thing. Like, we have to understand that it is what it is. It's a movie. it's not, you know,
and be all. And I think one thing we do a lot is that we'll see a movie and we'll expect it to check all these boxes. And when they don't check all these boxes, we have these, we hate it. And I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's fair at all to expect one movie to check all these boxes, you know? So, no one movie's going to do all of that. No matter how good it is, it's going to be some things that it's not going to check. And it's not supposed to. We're not
perfect. I guess I think that consulting the family, you know, I think was the thing that I think was great. Like they got the blessing, they sat down. I'm sure there was, and they said there was, you know, it wasn't an easy road. There was disagreements and there was things that they didn't want and vice versa. So I'm sure that happens. Yeah. That's going to happen. You know, you're talking about somebody's life here. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's tough, especially, you know, and I'm sure, you know, his widow, you know, she's the trauma of reliving this, you know? So if she wants something that's respectful, and she, you know, she gave it the blessing, I think that's awesome. I think that's, they should do more of that, you know, Hollywood.
Yeah, they should do more of that. Yeah, they should do more of that. Yep. So, yo, once again, DJ Distolo, what are your social media contacts?
It's Distolo, DISCDOLO on Instagram, on Mixcloud. I had an injury recently, so I'm kind of, everything's kind of been on hold. But everything that's on the, also on Twitter. So it's Distolo, DISCDOLO, Twitter, Instagram. It's DJ Dolo on Gmail. Like I said, you catch me on Mixcloud. I have some old mixes up there. I'm going to get back in once I recover from this injury. But you can check me on the socials. And I hope everybody have a good one. Oh, we definitely, I wanted to say, because I keep asking you to finish that small act. Maybe you can talk about that.
I'm going to definitely do that. It's a dope series.
And it's funny because it's British. It's the British experience, or the Black British experience, which we don't talk about at all. You know what I'm saying? Not that we don't talk, in America, we don't talk about it, or we don't really acknowledge it as much as we should. So it was eye opener for me personally. Like I would say,
it is. I have a homie in the UK, and she.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I'm
out. So I would definitely bring you in. I just gotta figure out how we're gonna do it, and I gotta finish watching it because she's been bugging me about it.
But it's really good.
Of
a West Indian. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean.
She's actually from Dominica. You know, so. So she's always schooling me on stuff, and I'm like, I definitely got to bring you on board. So yeah, we'll do it. I'm gonna get on that. I'm gonna try to get.
It's funny because like the West Indians, like they're like, oh, these horrible accents, and I'm like, I can't really tell, which is my ignorance and my bias. I'm like, but the everything else is kind of dope. But we can talk about it definitely. Let me know, man. Keep me posted.
Definitely, I will. So thanks a lot for being on the show on short notice. Definitely, peace, right, party people. And there you have another episode of Where My Killer Tape At. Shout out to my brother, man. I love you and I miss you, man. DJ Distolo. Again, if you want to get a hold of me, you go to the website omisbench.com, omisbench.com. All my contact information is there. Also, man, on the show notes, buy my coffee mug, man. Support the show, man. It's a dope mug. I bet you if you take that mug to work, everybody will be like, yo, where you get that from? Where you get that from? Trust me on that. If you just want to hit me up, the official one for the show is Omi's Podcast, OMIS Podcast on Twitter. And at Dan Trezomi, DANTRESOMI, at Dan Trezomi. Yo, if you want me to come through for your show, man, let me know, man. I'm open to that, bro. For real, for real. Peace, man, and be safe out there. Wear your mask, man.